Today's episode of Does Not Compute is brought to you by the fine folks at Rollbar. Rollbar takes the stress and pain out of dealing with errors in production. Instead of waiting for users to report bugs and then having to sift through log files trying to diagnose them, Rollbar alerts you to new issues and provides you with the context you need to get them fixed fast. That includes which users have been affected, request params, stack traces, and more. Even better, you can set up Rollbar to integrate with the rest of your workflow. Of course, you can integrate Rollbar with any major language or framework in just minutes, but you can also hook into your Bitbucket, GitHub, or GitLab source code to automatically link errors to code, or create issues and alerts in Trello, Slack, HipChat, Jira, and others. Check out rollbar.com/DNC, where you can learn more about Rollbar and sign up. Rollbar is giving everyone who signs up at that link 1 month free of their Bootstrap plan, normally $49 a month. Thanks again to Rollbar for their support of Does Not Compute, and remember to check out rollbar.com/DNC. It's been quite the week, huh?
It has been.
There were a lot of announcements.
I was sick for like a whole week and a half. And this week for DK has been specifically a tough one because of the changes I had to make. So yeah, it's been an interesting week so far.
What have those changes been?
So there was another pass on shipping. My boss basically wants to think of shipping as like a fluid thing where it can dodge and weave as it needs to.
You know, you're really not allowed to ship fluids under most scenarios.
You're not, as it turns out. Unless you're playing Factorio, you can ship whatever you want.
You should definitely think of it as a solid thing.
Yeah. But so then the goal was to integrate some sort of like packing, like a packaging together. Okay, so like say you order from three different stores and you order two products from each of the three different stores. So you order a total of six products, right? The goal there is to then package the items coming from each store together. So then you would only have three packages instead of six going out, right? I mean, that's a pretty standard thing. You know, Amazon does it for a good reason, obviously. So the last iteration of shipping, it would have calculated shipping prices for all six items. And now it's only going to calculate shipping prices for items that are packaged together. So there would have been, you know, only three calculations happening there.
Sure. So it's just kind of bundling things as appropriate into single shipments. And is that's something that is a combination of things that the merchant and the customer decides at checkout, or how does that work?
Yes. So a merchant can choose to have a flat rate. And so that kind of trumps everything. So we have, I'm using EasyPost specifically for UPS and USPS rates. And then we're also working with a regional shipper for the Southwest. If the customer chooses pickup, then obviously we just skip all that logic and the shipping is zero. If the customer chooses shipped, then if the item is small enough, so UPS and USPS have a threshold for items. They're basically saying like, you know, we won't ship items bigger than this. So I'm using that number. And if the items are smaller than that number, then I use EasyPost to look up rates. And if the items are larger than that number, then I have a table of internal rates based off of what B-Cubed, that's the shipping company, based off of what they sent me. And so it does the calculation there. And then it stores a rate. It used to store the rate on line items, but now I have another class called order shipment. And so now you have an order, and an order has line items, and an order also now has order shipments, and line items belong to an order shipment. So if one order has three different stores combined into it, then there would be three order shipments in that one order.
Well, that sounds like a blast, man. Shipping furniture and then dealing with multiple stores and pickups and all that. Oh my gosh.
It works really well. So I'm pretty happy with what I came up with. It sucked to kind of get to that point to try and figure out how to do this well. And the biggest pain was, this actually was kind of a retroactive update. So the thing I was most paranoid about was writing a migration that has to change existing data, production data and all that to match the new setup. So I'm pretty happy with how that came out too, because the migration, I wanted it to be reversible. So for example, I can do Rails, migrate Rails rollback, no problem.
Right.
And that's happening. I've tested that a bunch. And so I'm pretty happy with how it came out. basically, I'm just looping over all the orders and then looping through all the stores in each order and then, you know, building a new order shipment for each one of those and moving data from the product orders over to the order shipment. And I happen to get really lucky. So all of our orders so far, they've all either been like pickup or they've all been kind of special cases. So that basically happens when someone's ordering an item that's too big for UPS, but also outside of the region of our regional shipper. And so what happens is for the carrier and the service, we just set that to TBD. And in the receipts that go out to the customer and the owner or the store owner, and also on the checkout screen, it'll say, hey, you know, this is a non-standard route. So after the purchase, the store owner is going to get in touch with you and you guys can work out shipping.
Sure.
So,
it's like we can't do this automatically. You're going to have to discuss it with the person you bought it from.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. That makes sense.
Yeah. So luckily, all of our purchases have either been pickup or kind of non-standard. So I can reliably go through and update the carriers and stuff on order shipments. So I can distill multiple line items down to one carrier, one shipment or one service. Thankfully, because that is the case. Otherwise, it would kind of, I'm not sure how I would have had to do that or how I would have approached it. I don't even know if I would have been able to make some of that retroactive. But since that's the case, I was able to do that.
Well, that's awesome, man. It sounds like that's all worked out really well. I've kind of noticed something you mentioned a little bit ago. I can't remember the exact wording you were using there, but you basically said like it was a big haul and it took like a lot of figuring out to do, but then it all came together really nicely at the end. And that's something that I've been noticing lately with Nest Notes as well. Like as we're getting closer to launch, a lot of the things I'm working on are kind of bigger projects, and it can be pretty overwhelming because I'll feel like I don't really make any progress for several days, right? And I'll just be writing notes or thinking about things. But then what does kind of seem to happen is that by putting in that effort up front, and even though it doesn't really feel like I'm making a ton of progress, by putting in that effort and doing all that planning up front, I am able to actually make those things come together really quickly once I'm actually fully ready to do it.
Yeah. It took several days of thinking, and I think me being sick it just made it harder because I was tired. It just made me like really tired. So it was harder to think. But what really helped me out was I just wrote everything down into a GitHub issue. And that's what I typically do anyway, but I tend to break it up into sections. So I'll have at the top, I might have like a synopsis of like, here's what the intended feature should do and what should happen. And then, below that, I usually will add like a to-do list. So I just have two check boxes, which works out really well for the issue list because then you see X of Y in the list. And then under that, I'll have like, so basically I'll try to like poke as many holes as I can. So under that, it'll be like a heading of like, problem areas or something like that. And so then I'll just make a list of everything that could possibly go wrong. And under that, considerations, that's what I call it, considerations section. And under that, I try to go through and answer all the considerations. So I'll try to like figure out answers for them one by one. And that was really helpful for me, especially even before touching any code, because I had already thought through a lot of the problems and I already had come up with a majority of the answers for that. So I think decoupling that from actually writing the code. So instead of like coding for a little bit, writing tests for a little bit and then getting stuck and then having to go back and think for a while, I kind of skipped that whole coding and testing loop. And instead I was able to kind of stay in the same context in my mind, which it worked out really well.
Right. Yeah, that sounds very, very similar to what I've been doing with these Nest Notes features lately. Is I just write a lot. The first thing I do is I sit down and write and write and write and think more about writing and then write more. And just do that for a really long time until I have the entire thing planned out. And what kind of happens to me is that eventually I get to the point where I notice that I'm writing a lot more pseudocode than I was at the beginning, instead of writing about ideas and problems and solutions. And once I kind of hit that point where I'm writing more code in the document, then I'm like, okay, now it feels like I'm probably getting close to ready to actually dive in and implement this thing.
That's pretty funny because I do the same thing. I actually write a little bit of, I use like Markdown and all that stuff, the code fences, and I'll define classes and stuff.
Yeah, same.
Specifically for this, I had to do in the Rails app. I couldn't push it off until the Elixir app goes live. So I ended up like sketching out all of my classes up front in the writing. And then basically what was nice was when I started development, I kind of copied and pasted a lot of that into the code blocks. And then I made the specs for them. And then the specs would, you know, I could just go to town on writing the tests because I had a little bit of a baseline already kind of set up between the classes. So that, that seemed to work really
well.
That
is exactly down to the copy and pasting bit, how I did the NestNotes purchases a few weeks ago. All of our shopping cart stuff and checkout flow and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, it was like almost the entire thing was written out in notes and then just kind of migrated over into actual code files at the end.
Yeah, it seems to be working out really well. And I think my coworkers appreciate it. And like maybe they don't understand all of it, but they see something happening there. I mean, I'm pretty good at communicating with them as well. Like, here's what I got done today and here's what is still needing to be done for this item. But maybe it was like a couple weeks ago, I turned on the GitHub integration for Slack and I said, if this is too noisy, let me know. And they're like, oh, we love it, you know? So me writing in GitHub, it like actively notifies them that something's going on and they can kind of follow along and ask questions if they notice something that they don't understand. And that's been helpful too, because then Scott kind of chimed in with a couple of questions or things that I hadn't thought about when I was in the middle of writing my long thesis on how to handle this shopping thing. So that was really helpful to me too. So I think it's going to work pretty well. It's been working pretty well in development so far. I still have some UI changes to make to reflect that, but I'm pretty happy with how it's turning out. But I did want to talk to you about something else, and this is something that I'm really excited about. And that's the fact that whenever High Sierra comes out, I'll be able to use an external GPU with my new MacBook Pro.
That does appear to be the case. Apple's got that bundle. It's I think it's $600 right now, and you get a pretty decent video card with it. And it comes obviously in inside an enclosure, a Mac compatible enclosure. And it also right now includes $100 off on a Vive, which is pretty cool.
It's very tempting. It's so tempting, Paul.
Man, I gotta tell you, VR dev and just game dev in general, but specifically VR dev is just a blast. It's really, really incredibly fun stuff.
Yeah, it seems like it. I've been kind of checking out. I mean, it's not the same, obviously, but checking out web VR. I came across a really cool library called A-Frame. I'll put it in the show notes. But I've been having all these ideas of things that I could do with the Watch Nature UI, specifically around like photos and videos and stuff. And obviously I wouldn't need an enclosure for that, you know, an external GPU, but
hopefully
just the idea, I mean, just like looking at it has kind of been triggering ideas and, it's kind of getting me excited about working on some of that stuff. And that's, I've kind of been like in a little drought, like an excitement drought or like an energy drought. And again, probably because it was from being sick, but I was feeling burnt out before that just because of all the work that I've had to do and the kind of work that I've had to do. So this kind of stuff is, it felt like it's kind of giving more energy, and looking at some of the keynote specific stuff that Apple has been talking about kind of energized me as well.
Yeah, they announced just so much awesome stuff in the keynote. I was looking at the A-Frame docs there for a second. That looks pretty cool actually. But they announced some really, really cool stuff. I mean, obviously the external GPU support and the, you know, we're going to have Steam VR on Mac is, I think, huge. I'm really looking forward to that. Although that being said, if I were able to switch over right now, like if I had a Mac sitting on my desk at this minute that had full VR support and was VR dev ready, I probably still would be developing for VR on Windows right now.
Is that because of just the larger market share, or what's the reason for that?
Well, so I mean, I would probably set up, I would definitely do a port of Microcosm for the Mac if I had the ability to do it today, but I probably would still be doing my actual dev work on Windows, even though I would maintain the Mac port, just because this stuff is already just so, so bleeding edge. It's changing every single day, all the time. It's constantly something new, something breaks, something just different all the time. And on Windows, that's already bad enough. It's like so fast and just changing constantly. And there's always something wrong or broken. I mean, which is fine and expected, right? This is brand new stuff and it's super cool and really hard to pull off. And there's some amazing tech going on here. But then like also doing it on a beta platform where it's brand new. Oh man.
Right.
That sounds like probably a headache and a half. And maybe I'm overthinking that a little bit, but.
No, that makes sense. It makes sense. I mean, I'm sure just like first version of everything is going to be kind of strange. And it's kind of, you know, like thinking about how many people have been talking about problems they've been having with some of the newer hardware from Mac. specifically around like peripherals and dongles and all that stuff. I'm kind of having a strange issue with my monitor I mentioned in the Slack channel earlier, where randomly my monitor like power cycles for no reason.
Yep. I had the same thing for the longest time with my my MacBook Air. Or not Air, what are they? It's just called MacBook, 12-inch MacBook.
MacBook, yeah.
Damn Apple.
Yeah, so I mean, I could totally see that reasoning, you know. It seems like it might take a while for it to mature, because obviously, like, if you're doing something day in and day out, it would really kind of be annoying to have problems, small problems. You know, the small problems are what kind of break your focus and break your attention and all that stuff. So I could totally see that.
Yeah, definitely. Although I am super excited to try it out, though, and I might be totally wrong there. Hopefully I am. I would love to be proven wrong on that. Like, that's just super smooth and awesome from day one. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, that would be cool. I'm pretty tempted by it. I don't know if I'll drop the 600 on it, just because, I mean, so I'm not making anything right now where I actually would need that hardware. It's more of like an interest, I suppose. And I did just buy a new Mac, but I did also just sell another laptop that I had. So who knows, Paul?
I love hearing the gears turn on this internal strife.
Yeah. Well, I know that Jamie can hear me too, and she has some thoughts on that. She'll be like, oh, you can spend your money on whatever you want. But I'm like, well, I know when you say that, you have that look attached with it. And I know you don't, like, I know it means something different. But yeah, another cool thing that I was pretty stoked about was the AR stuff. I mean, we've talked about AR before, and I talked a little bit about how Facebook is kind of like going all in on AR and the camera and stuff like that. And obviously now too, Apple is doing the same. And that happens to be something that I'm very interested in, and something that I could build into Watch Nature as well. So yeah, I'm really interested in what Apple is coming up with there.
So for anybody who's not aware of what Sean's talking about, Apple announced at the keynote something called AR Kit, which is basically just a new framework that's available to developers on iOS as of iOS 11. It's super cool. I actually, on the day of the keynote, I actually upgraded my phone to iOS 11. I went through the whole song and dance, upgraded, got the beta Xcode, which is Xcode 9 now. And I was able to get some sample code running. So the way that ARKit works is that you can either use it with one of Apple's internal scene display technologies, which would be either a SpriteKit or SceneKit, depending on whether you wanted to do 2D or 3D stuff. And so you can use it with that and do it all within a native Apple ecosystem, which is really cool, obviously, that they provide all of the tools you need to make a 3D game now. I think that's pretty fantastic. Or what you can do is use a bridge between, right now it's either Unity or Unreal. Both support it, and you can have those and just do your whole project in Unity. For example, in my case, I would be using Unity. But you just set a couple things up, and then you actually just get planes in the real world that you can attach game objects to. It's really, really neat stuff.
That's wild.
Yeah, and I mean, I was able to, it's super rough right now. Like, the docs are mostly non-existent, and like the sample code actually had some bugs in it when I downloaded it, so I'm assuming some APIs changed last minute or whatever. But I'm sure all that stuff will get smoothed out pretty quickly. And I mean, I was able to get it up and running the day it was announced with pretty much no real hassle. So
yeah, that's really cool. I'm pretty excited about that. There's just things that I want to do, and with Watch Nature specifically, it's not so much like game oriented, but I'm trying to think of like more how can I make consuming media like photos and videos more immersive.
Sure.
And obviously like VR and 360 photos would be really cool. But on top of that, like the whole AR thing we've been talking about, you know, using like your device outside, let's say you're on a hike or something like that. And then we had like a Watch Nature app that had AR on it, you could use your phone as like a virtual tour guide in real time. But also we could, using our location data, you know, you could look around and be like, oh, well, so-and-so spotted this species here last week. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And if you have like an iPad or a phone, it just, I don't know. There's a lot of these ideas that are just kind of pinging my mind that I think would be really cool. And the crazy thing is that I used to focus on like, okay, well, even though I like Vue a lot, React has React VR, and Facebook is going to like go all in on this AR stuff. And it was really reassuring to me seeing like, okay, Apple's dropping all this stuff. And there's all these other bridges that you can use as well. Like, I mean, you could, where there's a will, there's a way. You could make it happen. So I'm kind of sticking to my guns and viewing all day long and happy with it and feeling good about the future.
Yeah, I see nothing that compels me about any of the Facebook or React VR stuff right now, just to be totally blunt. It seems completely uninteresting to me.
Yeah, I mean, the web VR stuff is interesting. Like, it's different, though. It's different than, because obviously you can't do as much. It's more limited. And then you're also kind of like shoving VR, like the scene setup, you're shoving it into an XML structure.
Right. And that's the biggest issue for me.
Yeah.
The advantages of having like an actual 3D scene editor, I think can't really be overstated. It makes it's such a big difference in terms of laying things out and visually being able to understand how your world is set up.
Yeah. So I'm just kind of like weighing my options, I suppose. And, you know, this last week I've been weighing my options and looking at what I want to do going forward. And I just like Vue too much to give it up.
Yeah, Vue is really fantastic. It
is really fantastic. Also, interestingly enough, if you go back to A-Frame and look at some of their documentation, they had this crazy 3D scene editor that you can toggle into for any of the examples, which gives you that, like, it basically zooms out and then shows you the planes. And it kind of gives you like a 3D application app feel.
That's really cool.
I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm actually looking at a GIF of that right now. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. But again, I mean, the source lives in an XML like tree, which maybe I don't know how well that translates across. It's kind of like when I was looking at React Router 4, like not hitting on it. It's, you know, it's useful for a lot of people, but it was interesting to me that everything is shoved into the XML style setup when maybe it doesn't. Like, to me, I feel like JSON fits that bill a little bit better. That's why I prefer Vue Router over it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yep. Everybody's got an opinion about something or other, right?
Yeah. I mean,
I'm not saying that. I'm not trying to be mean about that either. I guess it sounded kind of negative, but I mean that in like everybody has a different thing that works better or worse for them. Like that's just the reality of life. Like some people are going to take really well to the way that A-Frame or Facebook React VR thing or whatever else works. And some people are going to take really well to how SceneKit works. Some people really love Unity, others love Unreal. And there's not the only right or wrong answer is the one that's based on the needs of the project and the feature set of each option that you're looking at, right? At the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, it all comes down to what you're wanting to make and how, you know, how you want that to come out. I always find that I do better work when I'm not so focused on the technology I'm using, but rather the end result is what I'm obsessed with. And it's very, very easy for me to kind of get caught up in choosing the technology and choosing the languages and the frameworks that I'm using. But when that becomes the focus over what you're actually building in the long run, like your end product, that's kind of where I kind of run into problems personally. And it just leads to frustration, I think. So...
All right, Sean. So I know you actually don't have a developer account right now for iOS.
I don't.
And you are not running the iOS 11 developer preview.
I'm not going to do it this year,
Paul. You're not going to do it. Why is that? I'm curious.
Because I've made my decision.
Okay.
The biggest thing is that I just have other... I know that I would kind of like obsess over it and I would focus in on it a lot and... I have to do the shipping thing, which is harder.
Sure, that totally makes sense.
I need
sense.
My brain cells for that.
Yeah. So this is basically the first time I've ever had any sort of legit reason to actually install the beta. First of all, obviously, because I wanted to play around with the AR stuff. So I guess that's legit in air quotes. But also, I'm going to be shipping the Nest Notes app, iOS app, pretty shortly here. And I already know it works pretty well in iOS 10. And I know what the issues are that need to be tested. And I can easily do that in the simulator. But I really want to be sure that I'm giving it a good run through on iOS 11 because a lot of things do tend to change from release to release, especially in mobile Safari and how that works. And since this is a Cordova app, it's going to be affected by any of those changes.
Right.
But one of the first things that I noticed, and I don't think I'm imagining this, but unfortunately I don't have an iOS 10 device handy to like triple check it, but it appears that the the scroll deceleration, which has always been different in mobile Safari versus like native apps, or if you use like WebKit Overflow scrolling touch, that's hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
If you use that, it'll change it. Where like when you flick the page, it scrolls for a longer time, basically, right? So it feels more like a native app. But they finally changed that. This has been the case since as far as I recall, iOS 1, where Safari web views were always slower scrolling. And that seems to be no longer the case, where now if you flick it, it is exactly the same as a native app, which I think is fantastic and a long overdue change. So I'm very excited about that.
I don't think I've ever noticed that. But then again, I mean, I did work with Cordova a while back, but I was focusing on other things. I don't know if I would have ever noticed that.
So just go to any website. Like Daring Fireball is a really good one to test this out on, just because he's got a really long page that you can scroll through. And just kind of like flick and notice how far the page moves. And then go into something like a Twitter app or anything with a long feed. And then flick and notice. You'll notice that the web page decelerates a lot more rapidly. And that's always been the case, unless you use WebKit Overflow Scrolling Touch with a wrapper element.
That's interesting.
So anyhow, I am personally super, super excited about that change. I've been wishing for that for almost a decade now, I guess, which is kind of crazy. So very, very good to see that. And I don't want to turn this into like an iOS update show or whatever, but I kind of do a little bit because I think there's some really cool stuff that we should probably talk about. The control center, man, it got so much hate, like probably the most hate on release day that I've seen since iOS 7 itself, right?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
I like it. I personally like it. I thought it was awesome.
It's fantastic. In use, I agree. Like, it's not necessarily the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. But when you're actually using it, the icons are really, really clear. Like, what's what? It's very easy to see where things are laid out. Super, super cool. And one of the things that I wasn't watching the entire keynote, so I may have just missed this bit, but one of the things that I don't think they mentioned a whole lot was the fact that you can super, super customize Control Center now. So there's actually a thing in system settings now where if you go in there, you have the option to disable and enable and reorder all these widgets. So there's some really super, super cool ones in there. So obviously before there was like the flashlight and stuff, right? And the camera and the calculator. Now you can add in if you have an Apple TV, you can add in an Apple TV remote. So you have an Apple TV remote always available in your control center, which...
All right.
Fantastic.
I did not know about that.
Yeah. Nobody else seemed to know about it either, but you could just have it right there, force touch, and it just connects to your last Apple TV, and it's just there. You can do this directly from the lock screen without even unlocking. Super, super cool. This is the kind of stuff that I love when Apple does, because they've got, like, they have this whole hardware-software ecosystem, and this is just... taking advantage of it to the fullest potential, right? It's incredibly exciting to see.
Right.
So that the Apple TV one is one that I'm really, really excited about. There's also a quick switch to turn low power mode on, which I use personally a lot.
I do that too, yeah.
And this is one that I wasn't expecting at all, and I still haven't really seen mentioned in a whole lot of places, but you can actually add a little button in there. You've always been able to take screenshots on iOS, but now you can actually do screencasts. You can do video recordings. So from one tap or with a couple taps, anywhere you are on the system, you can open Control Center, start recording your screen, and you can have it record the microphone as well if you want. There's just a little toggle when you force touch, but start recording your screen, and then it just saves that video out to your camera roll like anything else. So you can actually do a live screen recording with audio directly on your iOS device, which is so cool. I think there are just 1.5 million use cases for this. Specifically for me, this is going to be great for getting bug reports.
Yes. Yeah, that's one thing I thought of immediately too. I noticed that I saw a video where you can export an entire site as a PDF as well.
Yes, yeah. You have a print to PDF basically now.
Yeah, it's very useful for bug reports and such as well.
Yeah, totally. It's also really nice because they added annotation tools into the Quick Look, the system Quick Look. So now if you print a page to PDF, you can actually sketch it up and like leave notes on it directly from your device. These are just some like really nice, I don't want to say pro level, but like power user-y kind of features that we haven't had on iOS before. And it's super great to get them on the system level. I think this is kind of a big deal.
Yeah, I I mean, that was one of the first things. So I didn't watch the whole keynote, but I was looking at Twitter, and it's funny when a pro level feature would come out because people just are freaking out about it. Specifically the screen recording one. Someone was like, I never thought I would see the day when this happens. So I think universally it's just a really cool update. I think it makes a lot of people happy.
Yeah, I'm incredibly excited about it, and I'm really looking forward to seeing how the beta progresses and kind of what they change, what they keep the same, all that. It's always, I just always think that's really fun. But so far I'm just really impressed. I like it a lot. I think it's a fantastic update. Thanks to this episode's sponsor, Rollbar. Rollbar simplifies production errors by intelligently alerting you when they happen and providing insights and context around what caused them. You can be up and running in just minutes with any major language or framework. To learn more, check out rollbar.com/DNC. Everyone who signs up using that link will get 1 month of Rollbar's Bootstrap plan, normally $49 a month. Take a look at rollbar.com/DNC today.